on, what, nope. Yes.
So before the break, Mike, you were talking about kind of the three-year wave, the three-year arc of this program, in which during year one, you'd be making contacts, kind of assessing needs, learning that people were interested in a certain thing, and bringing that, for example, if they were interested in seeing the opera, you might bring an mm-hmm. opera group mm-hmm. from Madison.
We did, in fact,
those communities.
Yeah.
And then in year two, it would be the time of infrastructure building, helping them start the mechanics for their arts council mm-hmm. in motion. And year three was the time of reflecting and writing on the experience and helping them maintain their momentum. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So tell us, so if that was kind of your overarching model, tell us what went on that was different maybe in each of the communities. For example, Rhinelander, you talked about the School of the Arts, uh-huh. and that was the one that you probably had the least connection with because the School of the Arts was kind of ongoing. But did you help start the Northern Arts Council, or was that there already?
No, that kind of grew out of the School for the Arts, which, as I think I made reference to earlier, was a totally different approach from what we used elsewhere. Because elsewhere, we went in and began by starting local arts councils and related groups. In Rhinelander, it was the School of the Arts that was the focus. And those early days of the school were pretty exciting. I mean, the professor always had an artist in residence come in. We had Mark Connolly, who wrote Green Pastures and had been editor of the New Yorker at one point, who, as I remember, you got a chance to dance with on the main street of Rhinelander.
I was his chauffeur.
Yeah. And Studs Terkel came one year, and August Derleth was there for two or three years, the character of the world. And it was a very exciting program. And then as the program went along, visual arts were added, music was added, dance was added. Tibor Zana's Wisconsin Ballet Company was in residence up there at least one year that I know of. And kind of coming out of this activity, and of course, the activity couldn't happen without a lot of local support and a lot of local participation. There was a incredible woman who is one of my favorite people, Dorothy Gilday, who was a high school English teacher. And Dorothy managed all the relationships with the community while we were there, she and Iris Ford. And then out of that grew this Arts Council, which I discovered last year when we came back to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the school. This Arts Council is the only one of the five communities that's still in operation and has developed an immense program. When Mario, you and I did that workshop a few years ago in Rhinelander, a workshop for community arts leaders, one of the people from the local library came in to talk and outlined for us the incredible, rich arts experience that goes on in that immediate area, and that all grew out of that Rhinelander School of the Arts, and then took root in the community, which was kind of unexpected. I mean, it was not what we were thinking would happen. Well, I can't say that. I suppose we did. I guess it didn't seem likely. But. And then in Portage, the thing that was going on there that Professor Gard wanted to capitalize on with the grants and why it was one of the test communities was a proposal for a theater, which I mentioned earlier. It was to be a theater where the audience moved, a multiple face stage. And as the scenes would take place, at the end of each scene, the audience would move around to the next stage. And that was, a lot of effort was put into that at that time. Eventually, they applied for a small business loan and didn't get it. And the whole project kind of went down the drain. But the people of Portage, Dr. Curtis and his wife, what's the name of the woman that I can't think of? Blanche Murtaugh. Blanche Murtaugh, and then there were several other people that got involved with putting together the Lively Arts Council, and they were very capable about getting things going and getting things started in the Portage area. And then about halfway through, I mentioned earlier today, the wife of the local newspaper publisher was part of the Lively Arts Council. And somewhere along the line, they had a falling out. She was kind of in charge of the local writing group, and they had a very active local writers group then. And she had a falling out with the rest of the Arts Council, and her husband, who was a very fiery young man, did as well. And so he started all kinds of negative publicity about the Lively Arts Council. And his wife and her friends in the writing group started a rival organization. And so the people of the Lively Arts Council, the board, decided that they would give an annual award called the Egotrope Award, Portage spelled backwards, for people who had done outstanding achievements in the arts in the local community. And the rival group immediately started the Dead Crow Awards. I've always suspected that this fellow, the editor, was an Irish name, I can't remember what it was. I've always suspected that he did all that with a twinkle in his eye to get more publicity for what was going on. Well, some years ago now, Mario had sponsored a conference here at the university to talk about arts programs in small communities, and you invited me to come and expound. And Dr. Curtis, at 90-something, was there at the conference, and we were on the same panel, and so I said to him, I always suspected that this was kind of tongue-in-cheek. Oh, no, he said, it absolutely was not. He said he was a very fiery young man, and we did something to get his hackles up. And so, but it got them incredible publicity in the local paper.
Lots of visibility for the arts.
Yes, yeah.
What about WAPUN? That was one that you were kind of the point person for, wasn't it?
Yes, that's true. And we need to explain at some point how that split in the responsibility took place. But WAPUN, basically, when I think of WAPUN, I think of a wonderful woman named Cornelia Hull. And Mrs. Hull was the wife of one of the local doctors, woman, I suppose, in her, older woman, she probably was 15 years younger than I am right now. But Mrs. Hull was a graduate of one of the Eastern Barnard, I think, a chemistry major. And she was somehow imbued with the spirit of organizing for the arts. Now, I've often wondered about that. You know, there's a great dearth of leadership. It's one of the small community arts problems, is there's never enough leadership to keep things going. But there are people like Robert Graves and Spring Green, and like Dr. Curtis and his wife, and Mrs. Hull, who somehow are imbued with this understanding that they need to lead community arts movements. And I suppose there are other people in history and in geology and whatever that have the same kind of urges, but this kind of natural leadership ability. And Mrs. Hull had that. And she brought together a group of people, one of whom I interviewed when we did the restudy of the communities in 2006. And they got an arts council underway and did things like go into the hospital for the criminally insane. You know, the Waupun's claim to fame is it's where the state prison is. And they're also the hospital for the criminally insane is there, where people like Ed Gein spent their latter years. And Mrs. Hull started a writers group in the hospital, and went in, and other people who were writers in the area went in every month and met with some of the inmates. And so that was one of the projects that they did. The other project, which was not, she wasn't the major impetus of it. There were some other people involved who were weavers and interested in fiber arts. And they started in a storefront downtown, a fiber arts center. And when I went back to interview in Waupun in 2006, I discovered that fiber arts center is not only still going, but it attracts students from all over southern Wisconsin. And that came directly out of the project.
That's wonderful. Well, I sort of saved Adam's friendship in Spring Green for the last two to ask you about, because in the book, The Arts in the Small Community, that emerged, that we'll talk about in a little while, that you helped to write at the end of the project, Adam's friendships arts council seemed to have been started by the county agent, who connected it to the need to revitalize a faltering economy.
Yes.
That he had an idea for, I think it was a wafer board plant, a ski area, and an arts council as being the trio of things that would revitalize the economy.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know more about that. And then after that, Spring Green in the book was connected to an environmental activism movement that the pristine landscape, the movement to keep billboards off of farms, and an arts council were woven. So let's start with Adam's friendship and talk about where that idea came from and what you did.
Yeah. Well, in Adam's friendship, as I mentioned earlier in the interview, we pretty much had to start from scratch because there wasn't a lot of consciousness about the arts there. But we did find, it's amazing what you find in small towns when you start tilling the soil. There was a woman named Mary Grignano who was an artist who had a restaurant, and she was interested in starting an arts group and I think a pottery group and got those going. There was a woman whose name I can't remember now, who was a poet, and she got a writing group going. And there were various activities of that kind that went on there. Now, as far as ever affecting the economy or helping boost the economy, I don't think we accomplished that. Well, what am I don't think? We didn't accomplish that goal. But we did get a number of things going in a place where it didn't seem likely that anything could happen.
Mm-hmm. And then Spring Green?
Spring Green was probably, I'm making this up, I don't know this, but it was probably the first arts council in the country that had an environmental focus. And indeed, the things you're saying are true, that they had right from the beginning, they had a billboard campaign to get rid of billboards, trying to get the architecture coordinated, so on. The man that was most instrumental in the Spring Green area was Robert Graves. Robert Graves was an absolute tyrant. I mean, he absolutely knew what he wanted and knew where. Helen O'Brien used to call him Boo Radley. He was absolutely focused on what things should take place and how it should be done, and was very adamant about making sure it happened. And he had studied with Frank Lloyd Wright in his early days, and this is what I think got him imbued with the idea that that the environment should be a part of the program. They took a theater, the old movie theater in Spring Green, and refurbished it so that it could be used for stage plays. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think it still is being used, isn't it? And then they turned around and named it the Guard Theater, and Professor was so embarrassed. He said, you know, they've redone that theater. You know what they're going to name it? The Guard Theater. And it was, you could tell he was proud as punch by it, but very humble about it at the same time. And the hope was there that there would be a resident theater in Spring Green that would tour the state year-round. And we did things like bring the Milwaukee Repertory Theater there for the summer, which was a mixed blessing. Imagine that undertaking. Imagine picking up a metropolitan professional theater, regional theater, and moving it to Spring Green. And then we also had workshop the second time Strasburg came to Wisconsin. The workshops were held in Spring Green. Boris Goldovsky came to instruct opera students. There was a great thrust to bring a professional theater kind of vibe to the place. And as I say, that didn't end up happening there.
Not directly, but now there's the American Players Theater.
Yes,
so maybe
yeah.
It sowed the seeds.
Well, I undoubtedly. You know, and that's the thing. I was so surprised and amazed when we did the restudy of the project in 2006 that in every community, while people did not remember the project, there was evidence all around that American Players Theater is one. That Karen, you were with, we went out and visited Spring Green one time when I was here. And they have a new arts council. They had a new arts council at the time, I suppose not new now. They were working regionally to do things. They were enthusiastic about the importance of the arts aspect of the community. And most of the people we talked to never heard of the project. But it had happened. It had happened there. And Adams Friendship, while the Arts Council disappeared and petered out, we found that they have one of the most active community theaters in the state. They built a new high school and have a huge performing arts facility as part of it. Now, how could that happen in a town like Adams Friendship? And this is going a little far afield, but I found out some years ago that the guy that produces the plays at the Kennedy Center, they have an ongoing series of plays for people, for tourists, when they come in there in the daytime. He's from Adams Friendship.
Yeah.
Now, I bet you if you tracked him down, I always wished I could, if you tracked him down and asked him about the project, he would have been, you know, like grade school or high school. I'm sure he wouldn't remember anything about it. But there he is. We ran into the same thing at Portage when you and I went over there that one day, and we were introduced to a guy who was there for the summer, who is a children's theater specialist, a nationally known expert, who comes back to Portage to do, or did at that time, came back to Portage to do a summer theater camp and production and so on. We asked him about the project. He had no idea. But he had been in high school at that time. And so, I mean, what the project did was get it into the air, get it into expect. When we did the restudy, the one thing we found out that was the factor that separated these communities from other communities was the expectation that the arts would be part of community life was more more embedded in the people of these communities than it was in other places.
This is Karen. Second, my turn again for a question, and that is, what kinds of support did you receive for this work over that 3-year period? And first of all, from the NEA.
Oh, this is probably going to get me sued. It started out, well, actually it started out very cordially, principally because, well, two reasons. One, as I mentioned, Charlie Mark was there, and he knew the project and knew the professor. And secondly, we were all flying by the seat of our pants. I mean, the endowment staff was all brand new, and we're trying to figure out how to be a federal aid. Well, as Mark's biography or autobiography, Reluctant Bureaucrat, really sums it up, because they were suddenly thrown into this government arena and trying to figure out what to do and what may happen. The first thing that we discovered was that that they had no right to give a 3-year grant, because their funding was annual, and the whole arts Council for the Arts, which included people like Gregory Peck and I don't remember who else, none of them had a clue that they couldn't give a 3-year grant. So here we were with the grant, and then we were worried about whether we'd be able to do it the second year. I was able, anytime I had a question, I was just able to call the endowment anytime. And then, a couple years into the project, the chairmanship changed. Roger Stevens had been the chairman. And then he went to the Kennedy Center, and Nancy Hanks took over as chairman. Now, Nancy Hanks' claim to fame was, she was a wonderful woman, but she had been Nelson Rockefeller's secretary, had a thoroughly East Coast background, and you can just about imagine how thrilled she was with the idea of people doing art. And then Charlie Mark had also left the endowment by that time, and a couple of other people took over. And I remember getting a call from a guy one day, and he said, what's this thing in your budget about administrative costs? He said, do you mean the university is going to take a chunk of this money for administration? And I said, well, yeah. I said, yeah, that's standard procedure here. Well, what had happened was, some years earlier, when the National Science Foundation started giving out grants, everybody again was caught unawares, and so professors would apply for these huge grants and get the grant and then go to the university and say, I now need offices for 40 people. And so in order to prevent that, they started charging a hefty administration fee as part of the grant. Well, he said, we're not going to be able to do businesses with universities if that's the way they want to act. And I said, you know, that's standard procedure. I said, if you ever expect to work with universities, you're going to pay administrative costs. We didn't understand about matching funds when the grant came in. And it was a very pleasant day when we discovered in-kind matching, because there we had no problem. You know, all these communities had all these facilities that we were using and all the manpower that we were using and sorry, or person power that we were using. And but it was constantly that kind of thing. Well, then once the leadership at the endowment changed, and this is the part that I feel bad about having to say, the community arts section of the endowment started getting a lot of negative comments and a lot of bad mouthing from some of the state arts council directors, because they thought that they thought they could make better use of the money, which, you know, maybe they could have. But and then there were certain people at the university here itself who were giving negative feedback to the endowment, about the project being corny and hometowny and not quality art and so on. And it reached the point whereby by the end of the project, they were more than happy to be rid of us. And didn't see anything. I was asking George earlier who the director of the original Council for the Arts in Wisconsin, the precursor to the Arts Board. The reason I was asking who it was, because I couldn't remember his name, was that I was in Washington at a conference one time after I'd moved to Indiana, and Oscar Lewick. And we were going in to see the Alvin Ailey Dance Company at the Kennedy Center, and on the way in, he said, well, I said something about the Arts and Small Community Project, and he said, well, we all know that was a scam, and didn't amount to anything. So I immediately, when I got back to my hotel room, called Professor Gard, even though it was late at night. And he, when Lewick got back to Madison, he called him and confronted him about, well, I was just offering an opinion. It wasn't serious. And so, but there was a lot of bad mouthing that went on. And you know, we had hoped, the endowment would see our project and the results of it as a doorway to doing more in the community and state levels than was being done, and that just didn't happen at all. And so that support changed over time. And then let's see, what you were asking about support from where else?
So from within Wisconsin. So first the university administration, then local leaders, other departments on the on campus, but also within the five communities.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. The administration at that time was fairly neutral toward it. They weren't all excited about it, but they were tolerating it. And I was thinking about this the other day as I was preparing and trying to think. I'm not sure what the fiscal arrangements were, because we were in the School of Agriculture and in the Department of Ag and Extension Education, but I think our budget came through University Extension. And I suppose that was because when the grant was certified, the professor was still in Extension, and so they retained that. So the only really real contact we had with the administration was that we kept screwing up about the budget. And so we get called on the carpet. And as I indicated earlier, the professor had no tolerance for fiscal matters. He believed he would do things like go out to a community and meet with an arts group, not just the test communities, this was elsewhere as well. And he'd say, well, in order to help you get started, we will make a gift of $100 from the university to your organization. And then he'd come back to Madison and forget all about it. And then we'd get a call saying, where's our $100? And of course, there was no $100 because there was no mechanism for it. One year we arranged for the Wisconsin Ballet Theater to go out to two of the test communities and do performances at $1,000 a hit. And after we got back and submitted the bill, we discovered that nobody had ever cleared it in the first place. And so we ended up owing Tibor Zana $2,000, which he never got. And I've often thought it was great that he was he was such a gentle soul, because otherwise he would have hunted us down and shot us. So at one point, there was a dean, I think his name was Montross, a dean of extension at that point, called the professor on the carpet about his about the finances and how he wasn't following procedures. And so he took me, the professor took me to a meeting with Montross, and at the meeting said, "Now, you're concerned about the budget and are sticking to it. Mike here will handle the budget from now on, and there won't be any problems." You know, Mike, who was the most math-anxious person that ever walked the earth. So we went back to the office, and I totally stunned. And shortly thereafter, within the days after, we were at a cocktail party. They were, I think they were introducing the summer season for the plays that were done on the road. And it was at Liza Bardwell's house. And I walked up to the woman that had been, she was getting a little stipend from the grant to kind of manage the books and so on. And so I said, you know, you're really going to have to keep better records on. She said, "I'm not doing that." She said, I'm not going to deal with that. I'm not being paid like that." And so on. So guess who got to do the budget? I remember going back after the cocktail party, back to Ag Hall and sitting there with the books in front of me and looking at them, and it was like they were in Greek. And all of a sudden, they started to blur. And I realized that there were tears going to, and I kept at it and kept at it until quite suddenly, it started to make sense. So I managed the budget from then on, which is probably one of the reasons that I wasn't retained after the grant, because I took it very seriously. And so I kept trying to bring the professor and our colleague Ralph Koloff and Dave Peterson into line and keep them on the budget. And it was like herding cats, you know. I mean, it just, I didn't make any friends at that. So anyway, that's the administrative end of it. We got some cooperation. We got cooperation from the music department. They actually, and I don't mean extension, I mean the university music department. They sent a production of to Fledermaus out to I think in cooperation with Madison Opera Guild, sent it out to two or three of the test communities. And later on, one of the people from Waupun, a countrywoman who was involved with Wisconsin Regional Writers, approached me and said, "You sent the opera to Portage." And I thought, "Oh, well, here's going to be some kudos." And she said, "Don't you realize that many of us are Dutch Reformed and you had drinking on stage? We can't imagine that you would have sent something." Well, you know, what could I say? We did have drinking on stage. But so the music department cooperated. We got some cooperation from several other departments. The place where we didn't get cooperation was from the rest of the Extension Arts faculty. And I've wondered why the professor didn't get more buy-in from them before he submitted the grant. And I don't know this, but I suspect that he was used to dealing with people like Jim Schwalbach, who had the same philosophy as he, where if somebody asked for something, you got it together and got it to them. Used to dealing with those people, Pop Gordon, people like that. And just about the time the grant came into being, Schwalbach retired, Pop Gordon had retired, and the people that came in, now I'm not saying everybody, I'm saying certain of the people that came in, had an entirely different philosophy. Their idea was, we will, if somebody asks for an art class, we'll get in touch with one of our buddies who teaches art at a nearby high school and have him go in and do the class. They operated on very set programs, that these are the things we're going to do, which is a much easier way of operating, of course. But they absolutely refused to cooperate. So we had to go around and find our own resources from local arts organizations here in Madison and elsewhere in the university. And then, when we would do that, then those faculty members would be angry because we were impinging on their turf. Like, we'd send in an art exhibit and they were mad because we didn't go through them when they wouldn't do anything in the first place. And beyond that, there were some of them that also made it practically a full-time job to badmouth Professor Gard. They claimed that he was self-seeking, that he was only interested in building his reputation. He wasn't interested in the programs of the university, which, you know, was the furthest thing from the truth. I mean, Gard had a reputation and he cultivated it particularly so that he could do the work and make the work more effective. And so there was all this backbiting going on, which was just incredibly annoying. I remember after I had gotten my doctorate, and Ralph Koloff then got his doctorate a year later, and we were sitting in a meeting with other Arts Extension faculty, and again, I don't mean to say that everybody was in this same boat, but there were people in the meeting who started denigrating our degrees. They said, there's no such thing as studies of community arts development. That's silly. Well, that's what they were, allegedly what they were doing. And I have never before or since had anybody sit in a meeting and denigrate my PhD. And these people had the temerity to do that kind of thing. And it was very disturbing, because it could have been a whole different relationship.
Well, now, one place you did get a lot of visibility was Mrs. Johnson, the president's wife, Mrs. Lyndon Johnson, yeah. Was sent from Washington with the Secretary of Agriculture, as I remember. Mm-hmm. And one of their missions was to come to the Spring Green program.
Yeah.
Could you just tell us a really short version of Mrs. Johnson's visit?
I can't tell you a short version.
Retire somewhere else afterwards and hear more. But for the purposes of the tape, could you just tell us a short story?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was a circus. This was one of Mrs. Johnson's beautification tours, and she came with a huge entourage of press, you know, and Orville Freeman and I think the Secretary of the Interior and a third cabinet member, I can't remember who it was, and Roger Stevens came along. He was just in his transition from the endowment to the Kennedy Center, and Roger Stevens was a great supporter of our project, and so he, I think, had engineered for her to make this as one of her stops. Well, you can't imagine the fall de roll, and I can only compare it to what it would be like today. I mean, I can't imagine the difference. You know, then we were driven crazy, and I just can't imagine what it would be like if Michelle Obama came out. They were to go to Spring Green and attend a dinner, and then see a performance of a play called Hodag, which was based on the mythological creature from Rhinelander, at the Gard Theater. So in advance, we had to submit a complete list of guests who would all be cleared by the FBI. Ralph and I went out to Spring Green and painted the scenery for the show. That was the way we spent the week leading up to it. Olga von der Lloyd Wright, who was still extend at the time, trumped everybody by calling the White House and inviting Lady Bird to stay over, which I think she did, as I recall, at Taliesin. And they put in 6 telephone lines at the theater so that they'd have a hotline guaranteed to the White House. Well, again, imagine what that would be like today. There'd be 112 phone lines. And so we all gathered, the people from the university gathered at Helen Dale O'Brien's place for drinks beforehand. And then we all went to a restaurant, this was the opening of that restaurant. It was Frank Lloyd Wright had developed a plan for a restaurant built around the pier of an old bridge that went across between Taliesin and Spring Green. And the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation had gone ahead and built the restaurant. And so the dinner was held at the restaurant at that time. And I remember sitting there and seeing this man standing looking in the doorway, looking totally confused because he didn't have a place to sit, and it was Orville Freeman. And then, and this is a story that only I am alive to be able to tell you. We all had to stop at the bottom of the park at the bottom of the hill and be checked off on a list to go in and so on. So on the way out and on the way to the theater, I'm walking with Ralph Koloff and his wife, Susie. And Susie says, "I know something you don't know." And we said, "What?" And she said, "Lady Bird whistles in the booth."
Oh my.
So then we went to the theater and they did the show. And then Mrs. Johnson went up on stage and congratulated all the actors and so on. She was not photogenic, but she was a very beautiful woman when you saw her in the flesh. She was a very beautiful, very gracious person. And then they went away and things went back to normal, you know.
So let's just, excuse me.
I just wanted to jump in because there's a player in this play that has been mentioned, but we don't have a lot on him, and that's Ralph Koloff.
Can you
say a word about Ralph and his part in the play?
Thank you so much, because every time I mention his name, I think, oh, gee, we haven't talked about Ralph yet. Ralph was the second PhD in community arts development and came along about a year after I. He was about 45, I guess. Visual artist out of Milwaukee. And at the end of the first year of the grant, we put together a national conference on the arts in the small community. And it was really quite a stellar quite a stellar cast of characters and attendees and so on. A big conference we had at the Park Hotel downtown in Madison. And we brought in Ralph, who was a graduate student at the time, brought him in to run the conference. And then it came to pass that we realized at that point that the project was bigger than the staff we had. And I think we had the second year of the grant, I think there was a little boost in the budget, if I remember correctly. And so we hired Ralph to co-coordinate. And that's where what we were alluding to earlier, where this split came, where he took care of Adam's Friendship and Spring Green, much to my relief. And I did Portage and LePond after that. And then Ralph was a co-author on the Arts in the Small Community National Plan as well. So he was a part of it. Now also after the grant was over, Ralph was hired to take over while Professor Gard went on sabbatical that next year.
So let's wind up this section with kind of a general question. It's sort of a closing. What were your hopes for both the, you've sort of addressed this, I guess, but for both the communities as well as influencing the young field of community arts development, what had you hoped to do?
Well, to put it briefly, we'd hope to change the what is this phrase from the book?
The last line of the book?
Yeah.
To alter the face and the heart of America?
Yeah, we expected to alter the face and the heart of America, which we hadn't quite accomplished when we finished the grant. There were a number of things we didn't get to do that we would have liked to have done. One was the professor had a dream of a major book of the community arts philosophy. And so he and Ralph and I recorded a number of interviews to lead toward the book. And then we all got too busy with everything else and let it slide. Now, I've thought ever since what a difference it might have made if we had been able to carry that through and had done that. We didn't. I was able to, Mario and I went through the Guard archives after they were set up and we found those transcripts. And so I edited them and wrote an did an article on those interviews and with direct quotes from people. But we didn't get to do that book. As I alluded to, the revolving theater in Portage, which was to be the centerpiece of the activities in Portage, didn't happen, which was a shame. And the hope was in Rhinelander that the School of the Arts would become a truly national event, something like Bread Loaf in the Massachusetts or wherever it is, or the Iowa writing program. It stayed more, I think, Harv would know this better than I, but it stayed more statewide rather than national, I think. There was to be a resident theater company in Spring Green that would tour the state. That, despite all of our efforts, that didn't happen. Waupun, because of the sculpture, now we haven't mentioned the sculpture, Waupun has a treasury of sculpture. They have the end of the
trail.
The sculpture by don't get old.
We're all shaking our heads too.
Taft, Laredo Taft. They have end of the trail there. They had several other important pieces of sculpture. And so they mounted a Midwest sculpture show, which was a huge affair and done in connection with a Chamber of Commerce festival in the city and so on. I remember they had Miss Wisconsin at the festival, and she sang something from Sound of Music or something. And then that finished, and there seemed to be no other plan for her. She sort of just stood there. And so I, Lord knows what chutzpah this took. I simply walked up, took her by the hand, and said, come see the sculpture show. And so I guided Miss Wisconsin and her mother through the Midwest sculpture show. And I mean, to this day, I wonder why somebody from the Chamber of Commerce didn't come and intervene or anything, but apparently they'd had their use of her and were done with her. So I took Miss Wisconsin through the sculpture show. Well, the problem was the sculpture show was such an undertaking that they really burned out the people in the area, and so it was to be annual, but it never happened again.
And yet Waupun is now a sculpture city.
Yes.
City of sculpture.
Yeah. Well, remains a city of sculpture. Yeah, that's one of the long-term results of the grant was that they've remained and have much more sculpture than they used to. Yeah.
Well, indeed, I mean, in the next section, we'll look back from 50 years later. But is there anything, last question or last reflection to wind up this section that sort of has taken us till the 1969, the project is over?
I just wanted to double check with Mike. The name David Peterson also has come up.
Yeah.
Would you want to comment on him so we have that on record?
Dave Peterson was already working for Professor Gard when I came on the scene. And his major interest and his passion was producing shows and writing shows that could be toured around the state. And so he was one of the resources, his theater group was one of the resources that we had to take to the communities. But also, they did wide-ranging tours. I mean, their company appeared at all the county fairs, or a lot of the county fairs, and any place where a performance was needed and people could pay a nominal fee, they would produce. So that was what David did and what his part of it was. So he had, and the year after the Milwaukee Repertory Company was at Spring Green, he had a company in residence in Spring Green that was supposed to be the basis of this ongoing company, which for one reason or another didn't end up happening. But yeah, David was very much involved in the whole thing.
Well, and as I remember too, didn't he do residencies in the Peninsula State Park that have become the Heritage, the Wisconsin Heritage Theater that's still going?
Yeah.
American Folklore Theater,
thank you. Karen, did you have a question?
I did. I really am interested in what kind of support you received in the five communities from the local governments and the local leaders.
For the most part, but that's not quite right. I would say overwhelmingly, the response was positive. The only place that I know of that there was any kind of reluctance was Spring Green, and that was because of some things that happened while the Milwaukee Repertory Theater was there, but there was some controversy because the actors from Milwaukee were corrupting the youth of the community, which meant that they were making marijuana available to young people. And then when people checked into it and explored what was really going on, it was the local kids that were selling the stuff to the actors. But that's the only really kind of real kind of disturbance that I can remember happening at all. Otherwise, city leadership was either neutral or supportive. And as we said before, great support from the county agents, particularly in getting started with the thing.
Did any money come forward, or was it mostly in-kind support and just word of mouth, we support what you do kind of thing?
Both those things, a lot of word of mouth, a lot of in-kind contribution. There was of course some local financial contribution, but nothing earmarked or nothing specific for that.
Okay. Thank you.
It strikes me now that we should have pushed for that. A little late, I guess, but anyway.
All right, well, let's take a short break again, and then we'll do our final section and kind of think about it all 50 years later. Mm.